Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Claudia Monticelli with another episode of Multiple Voices. My Multiple Voices podcast, true to its name, includes different series. For example, we have the Voices of Love, where we discuss relationships, the voice of empowerment, the voice of laughter and play, the voice of pleasure, and the magical voice of archetypes and how they change the way we live. But we also have the voice of memory that includes everything from history to discussions of past life regression. There's also writing voices, where we interview both seasoned writers and authors who have just started getting their feet wet with writing, and we learn what can work for you as potential writers. Our series called Voice of the Spirit discusses different forms of spirituality and religion. And then Channeling Voices is a series that covers what happens when you channel, but is also extended to mediumship. Take a moment to review this podcast if you've enjoyed listening, and leave a hearty 5 stars. I'd appreciate it. Enjoy your listening. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here with another guest. I'm here with Danny Brussel. And Danny Brussel has quite an interesting take on life in general, but more specifically what we should all be doing. And he's an avid reader. I have to assume this because from the information I have of him, it doesn't necessarily say that he's an excellent reader or that he can consume books constantly. But what does he do? He is, first of all, an internationally acclaimed speaker. And we get that because he's here too. And he's a best-selling author of 16 books. Now, if he doesn't read, he does write. 16 books is quite a number of books. First, let me say, welcome, Danny, to our show. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me, Claudia. Thanks for all you do to spread joy around the world.
You're sweet. Well, let me continue my job here. Two of the books that he's written have the following titles: Leadership Begins with Motivation. He'll be talking a little bit about that. And The Reading Makeover. And I love that title. I really do like that title. And because at least it presupposes to me that there's a new way to read, or there is a new perspective about what reading is. I'm going to forego all of the rest of the introductory remarks that I will include in the episode, and let me give it. So, which book came first? The Leadership Begins with Motivation or The Reading Makeover?
Yes. So, Claudia, most of my books have been about reading because I spent the last 30 years as an inner city teacher really trying to get kids to love reading. And one of the ways I would get students to read was when I was a middle school teacher. I was the only teacher who had no tardy students. And it's because I always started class reading a Paul Harvey story aloud to them. Paul Harvey, he passed away a couple of years ago at the age of 325 years old. But when I was a kid, I used to love it. At 12:15 every day, he'd come on the radio and say, "I'm Paul Harvey with the rest of the story." And you'd just be glued for 5 minutes trying to figure out who he was talking about or what company or whatever. And so when I read those to my students, a lot of those stories were about like the founding of Sears Roebuck. And none of my students know what Sears Roebuck is. And so I said, you know what? I need to write an updated version of a book like that. So I wrote Leadership Begins with Motivation, which is a whole bunch of little vignettes. And it was interesting, Claudia, after I read it, I wrote it, and then I was reading it, and I was like, huh, completely unintentionally, so many of my examples in this book are of white male Americans. And I was like, wow, that's weird. And so the
book
I'm writing,
why.
Well, so now the book I'm writing is predominantly minorities, females, and international stories, because I think everybody can be lifted up by those types of stories.
Mm. Well. So this really leads into why, okay? We on this show and on many podcasts, really, guests usually talk about their activity, what they like, their passions, and all of that. And what I found to be true is that they concentrate on something that was very important to them in one way or another. Either you were never an avid reader, or you hated to read, or you came across someone who really made it possible for you to read. Is it A, B, or C, or is there something else?
Yeah, it's the former, Claudia. I grew up hating reading. My father's a librarian. And I always hated the public library. They always smelled funny. There was always
ladies and gentlemen, now, you don't have the you don't have the benefit of a video. I see, because I'm seeing him in a video, behind him is this huge library with all these books, the same size, all different colors, very, very important looking. Go ahead, Danny.
Well, it's true. What happened basically was once I started teaching in the inner city and I saw a lot of my students didn't have a lot of the things that I had growing up, I said, shame on me. I mean, I was really blessed, Claudia. Both of my parents were in the home. We were lower middle class, but we never starved to death. We always had food on the table. My parents read in front of us. They read to us. And we always had plenty of access to reading materials. And so that really became a passion for me. I'm like, you know, every kid should have those types of resources available to them. And every kid, you know, I find schools do an adequate job of teaching kids how to read. But the question I always ask people is, what good is it teaching kids how to read if they never want to read? I teach kids why to read, because I've never had to tell a kid, go watch TV. I've never had to tell a kid, go play a video game. And I never want to have to tell a kid, go read a book. I want them to choose to do it because they love it.
Yeah. Let me wait. Let's just take a step back. Now, everything that I've read about you and that I read about you is a person who is working with school children. At an age, formative years, really. Well, they're all formative until we get to be 21. But how did you get into that? Did you have any experience in your lifetime that was linked to, say, the corporate world or anything like that?
Yeah, of course. So I was a journalist before I was a teacher, and I had a great job where I had exposure. I got to meet every major newspaper editor in the United States, and one major daily offered me a job doing the city beat for $16,500 a year. And then a friend said, oh, they're looking for teachers in the inner city in South Central Los Angeles. It's $25,000 a year. And so I became a teacher for the noblest of reasons, Claudia, for the high pay.
Money? Oh, yeah, and we're both laughing because you're not in education to make money.
Yeah,
no one is.
And what's been great, Claudia, is I've taught all age levels. I started off teaching high school students, then I went to middle school, then upper elementary to lower elementary to pretty soon, instead of preparing students for college, I was coming home with snot marks all over my pants from kids hugging me. And what I found, Claudia, is what works with a 12th grader doesn't necessarily work with a kindergartner. But what works with a kindergartner works with all age levels. Even today, when I'm working with corporate executives, a lot of the strategies I'm using are strategies I use with kindergarten students.
Oh, wait. I'm going to jump on that. Now, when you work with the older people, let's put it that way, why would you do that? Is it to motivate them to read? What are you doing there? What's a nice boy like you doing with them?
You go to most conferences, and the first question I look at, I'm asking, this is lame. Why has it got to be so boring? There's no engagement. Just because you have information presented to you doesn't mean you're going to retain any of that information. And so I find working with adults is the same as working with kids, is how can I get across points that stick in people's heads?
Maybe I've misunderstood. Now, you work with adults for them to be able to process written material better. Is that right?
Basically, with adults, I'm working on a lot of leadership skills. I train speakers and things like that. And it's just so many people were put in a school system, which is a one-size-fits-all. And now that I'm an avid reader, one of my favorite things to read are biographies. And I always laugh when I read biographies of successful people, because almost all of them have something in common. Almost all successful people dropped out of school at some point.
Yeah, and I'm isn't that amazing?
Why is that? Yeah. Like, what are we doing wrong in school? And so I'm always trying to figure out ways to keep people engaged so that they're actually, you know, constantly curious. They're not learning for a grade. They're learning to satisfy their curiosity.
All right, now I'm going to ask you the difficult stuff.
Okay, great.
On this side of the screen, right, I have come across, I have to say that a good 40%, if not more, of the guests that I have on this podcast have said to me, either before or during the episode, that they have ADHD, and I'm always so surprised about that. And I think, well, is it because they measure it so often in the United States? or and I've never heard anybody have that here in Italy, you know? So I'm thinking that maybe it's one of those things that, because when I grew up in the United States and I went through, I mentioned through the system, the educational system until the university level, there was testing every year. You know, I know, I still have the results. I was supposed to be a school director of a you know, grammar school or something like that. But could it be that it's due to the testing system?
Well, I think, Claudia, when I was a kid, ADHD was called curiosity. I think it's a nice little diagnosis that people conveniently like to accept all the time now. And in America, we love to give people a pill. And I just don't, you know, if people want to limit themselves by describing themselves with a disability, they can. But I mean, to me, and don't get me wrong, there's people that actually have a real condition. But I'm surprised it's as low as 30% of your guests. In my experience, it's usually 75 to 80% of the people say, I have ADHD, and then they come up with all these excuses. And so whenever I've been a leader of a team or a faculty, I always say, the next time you need an excuse, please just say this: Peru has a new dictator. And people say, well, what does that have to do with anything? I'm like, well, one excuse is as good as another, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Exactly. It is. It comes off to me as being an excuse. And I don't say this to you know, criticize, but it just seems so out of context when people say that to me. You know, it's like, I have high blood pressure, or I have a wart or something, you know. But now the other question.
Everybody's looking for a crutch.
A crutch. I'm linking something else to this. So, obviously, if you work with school children and reading, there are people who are dyslexic, and that is counterproductive to the reading process. Have you come across that?
Well, so just to make people feel better, in my research, over half of the Fortune 500 CEOs around the world are dyslexic. And what people have to understand is dyslexia is a reading disability, and all reading disabilities are curable. So first thing is, I'm a big believer in an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So if you feel like you or your child might have a reading disability, have them tested, get some extra help.
Right.
I'd rather attack it early than wait for it to blossom. But second of all, you know, then you just have to figure out, I've always told people, let's figure out what your weakness is and turn it into a strength. And so dyslexics are actually very good at processing information auditorially. So one of the things I always advise people if they're dyslexic is listen to audiobooks.
Right,
you know,
it's
just as good as reading on your own. So
what I was going to get in. Is it really just as good as reading on your own?
So I'm one of these poor pathetic people that's actually read every U.S. government study on literacy over the last 100 years. And all of these reports are always over 2,000 pages long. And there's always one sentence on page 100 that says, the research seems to suggest the single best way to improve reading is to be read aloud to. And then they never say it again because it sounds way too easy. One of my friends and mentors, Jim Trelease, the author of the Read Aloud Handbook, he said if reading aloud cost $129, every parent in America would rush out and buy it. And if we found out kids didn't like it, they would mandate it in the public school system. It's the simple things that make the biggest difference.
I never thought about being read aloud to improve. I mean, I don't even understand what that means.
Well, so I've asked tens of thousands of people, how did you learn how to read? And I've never had a person say, I've never had a little Claudia in the audience say, you know, when I was a little girl, my grandma used to have this book that she'd read to me. She'd sit me on her lap and we'd rock in her rocking chair, and she'd point at the words, smile at me and go, alligator, ball. No, I've never heard that. But they'll read aloud stories. They'll read aloud nursery rhymes together.
Wait, I'm trying to think now. look, I'm going to come clean. All right. I mentioned, you know, I came off the boat. We went, you know, my parents are Italian. My parents were Italian. With three sisters, we spoke English to each other, went through the English educational system. My parents spoke Italian to us. Okay, I go to Catholic school. It was in kindergarten then. I don't even think it was first grade yet. The Sister Mary puts me in a room with three Hispanic children. And because I knew another language, she thought that I could teach them how to read. And I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So she gave me a blackboard, and I thought that was cool. She gave me some chalk, and I thought that was cool. And then we were just playing. You know, we were just playing. We were talking to each other and trying to understand each other, and then just started writing things. But I you know, I can see the mouth forming. We would talk to each other, and the mouth would be forming, and people would see where the tongue is supposed to be going and how to read aloud something. But I'm still not sure, Danny, exactly if that has anything to do with actually reading, because your definition of reading may mean, and I'm not sure, you correct me, getting information into you through the means of looking at data or looking at, you know, a source, whether it's audio or written. I'm not sure. What exactly do you mean by reading?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to, I'm making fun. I think that one of the things I always say is, you know, there's a big phonics movement in America. And I'm like, well, that's great. But just so you know, English is not a phonics-based language. I mean, Spanish is. I can teach anybody.
Wait a minute. I didn't get that. What is the phonics movement?
English is not a phonics space. It's based on looking, associating sounds with the letters, and I'll tell you
why. Oh, of course not.
Yeah,
no, of
English
course
is not a phonics based language. I mean, Spanish is. I can teach you how to read in Spanish in 6 weeks or less. Mama, mi, mo, mu. Nice and consistent. You'll understand the point. When you look at the letter A in Spanish, it makes one sound. Ah.
One sound. Yeah.
Always right. Ah. In English, ah, ah. Sounds like I'm about to vomit. Makes 18 different sounds.
Exactly.
Not a very useful strategy. But again, don't get me wrong. I definitely believe that you need to have some explicit instruction where the child understands whatever said can be read. But where the big problem is that we spend so much time on drilling kids, they lose any kind of interest or passion or curiosity in reading. And that's always the question I always ask people is, what good is it teaching a kid how to read if they never want to read? You know, people who love to read are lifelong readers. They don't do it for a grade. They do it for themselves. And so that's what I'm trying to do, is to really bring alive reading. So, and, you know, the research is really clear on this. It doesn't matter what you read. What matters is how much you read. It doesn't matter if you're reading James Joyce or James and the Giant Peach. Yeah. People who read more read better. So, and one of the things I tell parents is, little boys, the little boy who only reads books about Captain Underpants and snot is going to be a better reader than a little boy who refuses to read anything. You know, Captain Underpants and snot books are the gateway drugs to Shakespeare. But first off, you got to get the kid hooked.
Yeah. Well, I've been teaching a long, long time, but I've never taught levels that you're teaching now. I've forever taught in academia, but I have two kids now. Yep. The first one always lied in bed with us with the book open, and he was maybe two. He didn't understand what he was doing, but we were reading, so he just kept, all right, this older, my first, is, you know, a scientist. I'll just say that, as a scientist, and just devours everything. Could read, you know, the yellow pages, just puts it under the covers, you know, into the blankets. When I had the second child, I tried. He never read Captain Snot. He never read Mickey Mouse. Nothing. I couldn't get him to read anything, and I started thinking, well, what does he like? He likes cars, and so I thought, okay, I'd get him magazines. That didn't work. Then, you know, I saw that he was start sort of leaning toward female figures. And so I tried to get him to do that. And so what my point here is, even just with the language, the English language, because they grew up in an Italian environment, and English was there. And then at one point, 2.5 years old, my first son said, basta. Basta, mama, no more. He figured out he was the only one talking English to me. And he came home, he said, that's enough. And that was it. He's now bilingual, but he did it on his own. Mm-hmm. He did it on his own. The one who never read has perfect diction, pronunciation, perfect, picture perfect. But he reads only when he wants. If it's something to do with some kind of machinery that will help his new blah, 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 he goes and he'll spend hours and hours and hours. And, you mentioned before, early on, when we first came on, you mentioned, and it was very passing, you said, I don't convince them, or I don't suggest that they watch television. I work with reading. You know, you mentioned television very quickly, mm-hmm. fleetingly. And I thought there, let me get back to that. Because there are a lot of children who are very observational based. They will just watch. All right, let's say television, because that's the closest thing to home. If they go outside, sports, they'll go and they'll watch all of the way everyone behaves. Mm-hmm. And then what I found is that there's an inexplicable development that occurs, and then they put the observation together with any other source of information that comes to them. And what I'm getting at is that, unfortunately, the school system has a certain number of years. And they've mm-hmm. got programs. They have to do this, you know, geography, history, all of that in a certain amount of time. And I understand that motivation is very, very important. I'm positive about that. But I'm wondering, isn't it a little upstream? Isn't the difficulty a little upstream because there's, you know, the way the program comes down to bear on students at that age?
Yeah, I love that, Claudia, because I think you're identifying what I identify is, look at your non-reader son. He won't read anything, but all of a sudden you give him something he's actually interested in and he'll go off for 4 hours. I mean, when I was in high school, I was forced to read The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And no offense to anybody who loves The Scarlet Letter, but the story is about Hester Prynne has to wear an A on her chest because she committed adultery. And I asked my teacher if I could wear a B on my chest because I was so bored reading that book. And it just made me hate reading. Whereas I'll give you an example. I was teaching a little boy, a second grader, Kiara.
Yeah.
And Kiara's first grade
teacher. How old are they in second grade?
8 years old.
Okay.
So Kiara's first grade teacher told me, Kiara don't know nothing. I'm like, well, thank you for that. Well, Kiara, who don't know nothing, came into my classroom one day and he's like, hey, Mr. Bissell, you see Barkley last night? He had 18 points and 16 boards. And I'm like, thank you, Kiara, because from that point on, every day after lunch, I'd sit him on my lap and we would read the LA Times sports page together. And guess what, Claudia? Kiara was one of my best readers at the end of the year, and all that kid ever read about was sports. Now, eventually, I think it's important that he learns a little bit more academic reading. But even then, I give this argument to people. If you talk to Warren Buffett, who reads probably 8 to 10 hours a day, are you going to ask him, oh, please analyze this French romance novel? No, he's not reading that. He's reading things that he's very interested in terms of his stock portfolio. He's very narrow in his reading, and there's nothing wrong. The more you read, the better you get. So whatever you are interested in, I tell business people this all the time. I'm like, you know, if you're a leader, you know, you should be reading leadership books. Read about how to become a better leader. You don't have to spend time reading whatever they force fed. I was just doing an interview on live Nigerian television, and one of the problems I see in Nigeria was Nigeria used to be a British colony up until the 1960s. And so their school system is still based on the English system. And so the students are required to read Charles Dickens and Jane Austen and William Shakespeare. And there's nothing wrong with those authors. They're great. Yeah. But to a Nigerian kid, maybe they're interested in reading from a Nigerian author like Chinua Achebe or something like that. You're in Italy. I mean, kids should be reading things by Italian authors. I mean, I'm going to read Pinocchio because Pinocchio is Italian. Right. You know, I used to work at a preschool for homeless Latino kids in downtown Los Angeles. And one day we got a whole bunch of books donated to us in Italian. Now, none of us spoke Italian, but I can decode Italian. So every afternoon I used to read to the kids. Some of the kids, it was their favorite part of the day. But just because, and this is where I was going to go with the phonics argument, is just because you can read words quickly doesn't mean you understand anything.
Oh, I mean, of course not.
I do that all the time when they show the FBI videotape warning in French. I love to do my French for my wife. I mean, I sound great, but I don't understand a word I'm saying. You know? And it's the same thing. I see kids a lot. If you ask a kid who's the best reader in the class, I bet you almost every kid always says whoever the fastest reader is. And that's a big mistake because reading is not speed. Reading is understanding. And I've seen kids that can go, once upon a time there were three bears.
Yeah.
And you're like, what did you just read? I have no idea, but I can read the, I mean, it doesn't mean anything. And so there's a happy medium. And again, I don't want to put down actually, because you had talked about it. I agree. In the English language, blends are fairly consistent. A blend is two letters together, like a TH almost always makes the same sound. So I think having a kid recognize those things is an important teaching moment, but I don't think that's the end all be all. I think you also have to give kids a joy of literature and forcing them, you know, whatever it is that the school system thinks is supposed to be read. I'm like, well, I mean, you know, literature can be all kinds of things. I'm sure Mark Twain wasn't popular in his time as being literature, but it's literature now.
Yeah. While you're talking, you made me think of, for many years, and I still am, you know, formamentis, I'm an interpreter, conference interpreter, one language in, the other language out, right? And there are different modes of interpreting. One is, of course, the UN setup with the earphones in a booth, a soundproof booth, and one goes in and something comes out. Another mode of interpreting is the type of thing that we do in press conference. You have a pad, like usually a stenography pad, and someone speaks. You take notes, and after the argument is presented, then you give it to the delegate who's next to you usually, or you whisper interpret it. Now, in this second mode, the it's not stenography, but it is based on icons. It's a very personal system, but there are general rules. And I've published extensively on that now.
Nice.
Yeah. So son number two, okay? Uh-huh. There are history books. You have to study, right? You have to study because at one point you have to take a test and you have to get out of that school. If you want to go anywhere, you have to get out, right? And in this country, we have at the level of the eighth grade level, say that's middle school, at the end of middle school, there is a national test. And at the end of the high school, there is a national test. And one of the topics, you have the basic Italian math, you know, the typical. There was a history component, and it was so difficult because even if you don't read it for pleasure, because I could fall asleep just reading, it's a perfect thing, you know, for me to sleep to. But it had to be done. So I took this system and I said, okay, let's start drawing, you know, what we're reading. And so we had these sheets in the kitchen and it was easy peasy because it was out there. It was all out there. And the interesting part of reading is, well, people who, it's almost a game. You get to read and you get going so fast and you want to go slow and you can go fast, but then sometimes you want to go slow. And some people read diagonally because we do that to get the information from things, right? when you start trying to reconceptualize what you're reading, just to have a conversation about it, is when the problem starts. We can say that's for a test, or just to have a conversation, or just to tell someone about it. Now, I'm wondering if when you talk about motivation, what are the ingredients for that soup? I mean, what goes into that?
Well, motivation, I always tell people, different strokes for different folks. If you have, you know, I think that's, first of all, you had a great strategy, Claudia, because I always tell people everybody has their own way of learning. So yeah. I learned from because I stuttered as a child. And I was blessed to have a woman who eventually she would sing things to me, and I would sing them back without it was kind of like the movie The King's Speech. Eventually, I lost my stutter and I became a swan.
And here he is. Voices, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly. Well, it was kind of cool. I was speaking in India, and I had this little boy who was missing his left arm, and I had done a motivational speech, and he had tears in his eyes. He's like, "But what kind of hope is there for me?" And I said, "Well, when I was your age, everybody called me stupid because I couldn't speak right, you know. And isn't it interesting that the boy they said was stupid, who couldn't speak right, now gets paid ridiculous sums of money to go around the world to do what? To speak." And he had a big smile on his face. And it's something I always tell kids. I'm like, don't let anybody define you. You're the only person who should be defining you. And all of us have our own motivational tool. And so for me, I was really good with songs. For some reason, you stick it to a song, it sticks with me. For it was doing those pictures with the history. Oh, I'm going to bring that. I mean, Walt Disney said people think in pictures, and I completely agree with him. Was that was a really good strategy. I'll offer people, I was actually doing this exercise last week with a bunch of executives, is I gave them a vocabulary quiz. I gave them 20 words to learn in 10 minutes. And I said, okay, I don't care how you did on the quiz. What I'm interested in is what did you do to study the words? You know, and so some people, they said, well, I memorized them in order. I'm like, well, that works unless I change the order, then it might be a poor strategy.
Some people said,
okay, I made a whole story using the words in the story. Like, that's a good strategy. One person did what you did. They drew pictures with the words and they could remember the pictures. One person used parts of speech. One person cheated, and I thought that was a great strategy. I'm like, cheating is a very good strategy. But I tell people this all the time, is that I'll get interviewed and people will ask me, well, what's the solution? And I say, you're asking the wrong question. The proper question is, what are the solutions? Because it gets back to different strokes for different folks. You know, some kids work better on a one-to-one basis. Some kids like working in small groups. Some kids like working in large groups. Some kids process better with their ears. Some kids, they have to move and feel everything. Some kids, they do it with their eyes. You know, everybody's a little bit different. And that's what the struggle is for most teachers, is I say, well, if you have 33 kids, you basically have 33 different learning styles in that room. And you have to take the time to figure out, well, here's the gas that fuels Claudia, which is a different type of gasoline that fuels Danny. So motivation, there's not an answer. There's lots of answers. And that's where the art is trying to figure out what is it that fuels every single individual.
My next question was the numbers. What do the numbers look like? How many students are in class? Is it 33? Is that a norm or max?
Well, I taught in the inner city, so we always had, I mean, mine was ridiculous because I always had at least 33 students. And since I was a dude, everybody just assumed I was the disciplinarian. So they'd give me like 10 discipline problems, which is a huge mistake because I'm like Mr. Play. And I did that. You know, my own children in their schools, I think it's almost, it's like 18 to 1 is the ratio. You were saying you went to Catholic school. I mean, I still have the welts on the back of my hands from all the nuns smacking me.
I don't want to think about it.
I mean, when my friend again, Jim Trelease, when he was in first grade, he said that there was 93 kids in his Catholic first grade classroom. And it's one of my favorite lines of any speaker. Somebody asked, oh, did the nun have an aide? And he's like, yeah, he was hanging on the wall. I thought that was a great line.
Oh, God. Sister Mary, at lunchtime in my family, we ate Italian food, you know? So when we went and we had lunch there, and they had these cheeses that were orange, slices of cheese that were orange, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And that's when she forced us to eat it. It was terrible.
Well, you would have liked that when I was, I can do a whole presentation just on going to Catholic school.
On cheese?
In fourth grade, we were at the cafeteria and there was this bowl of apples and Sister Teresa had written a note that said, please only take one apple. God is watching. And at the end of the line, there were cookies. And my friend Casey wrote a note, said, take all you want. God's watching the apples.
Right.
Which is great. And to me, when a 10-year-old can think of something like that, as a teacher, I love that. I'm like, that's a creative. Yeah, I love that. I would praise something like that. We got in trouble, but I would have actually encouraged that kind of behavior.
So before we started the episode, you mentioned that you were in Los Angeles inner city, but then you moved to Colorado. Mm-hmm. Did that change the nature of your work, or are you still working with those age groups?
Well, I don't really actually even work with that age group, Claudia. I go around the world. I pretty much train parents, teachers, executives.
I see.
How to make reading fun. And all I need is an airport nearby. Uh-huh. You know, it doesn't matter where I am at. When we moved here, I told you my wife was much smarter than me. My criteria was that we had to be near a major airport and we needed to have the kids in the best schools in the state. And so we were I'm not as satisfied with the schools here as I would like, but you know,
what can you do?
It doesn't matter. I mean, again, I always tell parents when I have parents come and they're all concerned, what can I do for my kid? The first thing I say is the fact that you're here right now tells me 80% of what I need to know. Yeah. We can work on the other 20%, but if you're that concerned about your kid's going to do fine. Yeah. It's the kids that don't have that advocate for them at home that I worry about.
Do you have anything to do with families who homeschool?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually homeschooled my youngest daughter last year. It was amazing.
Was there a reason for that specifically, or?
The pandemic. The pandemic really, it kind of screwed up. The school my youngest was at had a really bad system. I didn't think she was learning anything. And I really believe that I was actually very impressed with the homeschool program we put her through. The only reason she's not in that this year was I was a little bit concerned about socialization. I wanted her to have those social opportunities with other kids. But I mean, I people always will say, well, what's the solution? I'm like, public school for some kids, private school for others, homeschool for some, vocational school for some, magnet school. I mean, there's all kinds of different strokes for different folks. And I look at all these people that fall through the cracks, and that's a total failure. I'm appalled by that. I'm like, wait a sec. We should be able to find something that fits the needs of that kid. Your second son is a perfect example, whereas if I put him in a school where instead of having assignments, he designs his own curricula, where instead of doing a science project I assign, he creates his own science project. I guarantee you, not only is his science project going to be better, he's going to spend 10 times as much time on that than the stupid thing that I assigned him because he's interested in it.
Yeah, but I mean, this kid went on to be to being a musician, part of a band, you know, small town. You know, they just, you have to find what moves them, you know?
That's right.
Really
that's
interesting. Right. I'm thinking of years ago, I could safely say maybe 5 or 6 years ago when it started, I might be wrong. In Europe, there was a portfolio system where that favored Roma populations that wandered. Went across borders. And they had sort of a portfolio. They would be working from their mobile homes or from wherever they did it with their computers. And whatever they did, whatever exams they took, they would put this in the profile and in their portfolio, and then would go on to the next school in another place. And it was interesting to me. It was an interesting thought, but it's a form of homeschooling, mm-hmm. but has a lot of, you know, loopholes, if you want, because it would be missing a lot of things that a public or a private school would have. But I found it to be so interesting, this concept of a portfolio, you know, with things that you just add as you crossed borders. I thought that was really, really interesting. So now we're to the books. Now, I'd like to close with the notion of the books. When did you write your first?
Good question. It was around 2004, I think, is when my first book came out. I co-wrote it with a gentleman who was famous in his field, and his contribution was he put his name on the book and wrote a biography that was twice as long as mine for his little excerpt, and I'm the one that actually wrote the entire book. And to me, that was a big mistake on his part, because whenever I see his name on anything, I question if he wrote it. I know that I wrote it.
What was the title of that first book?
Oh, I'm not going to say, because then I'm throwing the other author under the bus.
Okay. All right. So when you started writing, and this is just to get a little bit of information of your style, when you started writing that very first book, did you already have an idea for the upcoming series or partner books?
So the first books I was writing were very academic in nature, and basically, they were books that addressed issues that teachers were asking about. Well, right. How can we do that? Right. Now I like to write books that are inspirational, that get people pumped up.
That's a whole different genre, a whole different register, a whole different language.
Different genre.
How did you do that? Easy to do? I don't want to say dumb down, but get the proper lingo or register to do that. Was it easy for you to do that?
It's every book's a different experience, and so probably the easiest book I ever wrote was I have lots of different keynote addresses that I do, and one of my keynote addresses I had delivered probably 200 times, and somebody asked for a book version of it. I wrote that book in 3 days because the whole speech was in my head, and I love the book. It's very good. Mm-hmm. The leadership.
But will you tell me that name? Will you give me that title?
Yeah, that one's called A Baker's Dozen of Lessons Learned from the Teaching Trenches. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus on that one. And it's interesting because I've had five different publishing companies, and I've also self-published. Mm-hmm. And so
five different publishing companies. They're not your own. They're not
my own.
That you own. That you've worked with.
That I've worked with. Yeah.
I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, that was kind of selfish, because when I go to conferences and these publishing companies have parties, I want to be invited to all the different parties. And so I made sure to find different publishers so I could go to the different cocktail receptions.
Every
book's
first...
a different experience.
I know. And I love that writing experience. I just love it. It's like
I'm a little bit different, Claudia. I don't like writing. I like having written. Writing is hard.
It is. It's very hard, but I love that experience. Mm-hmm. The process, I love it. I just absolutely love it. It's very hard, but I think it's that difficulty that is a challenge for me. And when I get over those little challenges, you know, I love it. It just makes me feel so, and it just never ends, you know, unless you say, okay, that's the end. Boom. In Italian, we say mettere la parola fine, the end. You have to write that the end and get on with it. the process of publishing with publishing houses, was that early on, and then you went into individual publishing and independent?
Yeah,
or
correct.
Or vice versa?
I started with traditional publishers, and now I self-publish because my turnaround time is a lot quicker if I self-publish. I run one of the largest book clubs on the planet, and I used to be able to, people always are sending me
Can you tell me that name?
Yeah, no, and this is all your listeners, it's a free subscription, and you can go to lazyreaders.com, lazyreaders.com. If you subscribe, it's a free subscription once a month for the rest of your life. I update it with 10 new book recommendations, three or four adult level, three or four young adult level, and three or four children's level books, all under 250 pages, so you have something you can read when you're stuck, when you're in a boring meeting or something. And it, so people are always sending me, I probably get about 5,000 books submitted to me every year for review. And it used to be.
Well, how do you do that? How can you handle that?
Yeah, so Paul Tagliabue, the former National Football League commissioner, when he retired, somebody asked him, what are you going to do in retirement? And he said, well, I'm going to read a lot more than the first and the last chapter in books. And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. I have to read books pretty quickly. There's very few books where I can just sit there and go word for word.
Of course.
You were kind of talking about that with the
diagonal reading. Like,
I need to go for the gist. I can't go for every single asterisk.
It's
and
a
comma.
Skill. Yeah.
And so what I started seeing is that a lot of the self-published books started looking like regular books. I'm like, wait a second.
Yeah. It could be.
There's no purpose for a publisher if I can like, so I'll give an example. Like if you go on CreateSpace, which is on CreateSpace on Amazon, will allow you to self-publish a book. Well, any major publisher I've ever worked with, the most royalty they'll give you is anywhere from 6% to 15%.
Right.
Well, Amazon's commission is 70%.
Of course. Of course.
So
yes.
Why am I going to waste my time with a publisher who's not going to do anything to sell my book?
Yes. Let's be fair. Uh-huh. If we're fair, we have to say that your initial five books, let's say five, whatever, were published with publishing houses. And you were generating, you know, you're talking here, there, people know your name. It's being tossed around. Your books are being sold. And you're in a process. You're a tourbillon. I mean, you're moving, right? Mm-hmm. If from that experience you start independent publishing, it's a different ballgame because people know who you are. People, you know, it's the process of selling and marketing your book is a little easier then, don't you think?
I don't know if I agree with that, Claudia. I think that no publisher is actually going to go on your behalf to sell you. I mean, they might put a blurb in their catalog.
True, that's
Here's
true.
The titles
that's
that
true.
We have. But
of course.
Every author is going to tell you that it's up to them to market their book.
Yes.
And so you go on podcasts, you go do your interviews, you speak at conferences and say, hey, my books are in the back of the room.
Right, right.
Publishing companies don't really do a whole – I don't want to overgeneralize. I mean, if I was J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, I would definitely be working with a traditional publisher because the publishing company would treat me like a rock star and they would book me and these things. Mm-hmm. But even a person like Wayne Dyer was in the – he's passed away. But when he was in the personal development world, I mean, he personally got in his car and went to every major public broadcasting station in America and sold his book that way. It wasn't through his publisher. It was through him. That's the way you build an audience. I mean, if you look at one of the best-selling books of the last – I mean, I used to do a presentation just on self-published authors. I mean, Mark Twain started off as a self-published author. John Grisham started off. Edgar Allan Poe. One of the best-selling books of the last 30 years is The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. He self-published that book. Jack Canfield's, they self-published Chicken Soup for the Soul. I mean, you're talking some of the most glorious titles.
You have not mentioned one woman. Shame on you.
Absolutely. Well, and it's interesting because no,
you said Rawlings. Yeah, come on. Initially, you mentioned Rawlings.
J.K. Rowling. She didn't self-publish though. I'm trying to think of a woman that self-published. I mean,
that's a big name.
You know, for me, I used to do a presentation like, "Thank goodness for wives," because so many wives.
I wouldn't
guy,
go down that road.
Well, there was a guy, and he kept on sending his books to an agent in New York City, and the agent kept on rejecting him. And finally, he wrote this book, and he looked at his wife, and he said, "What's the point?" And so he threw it in the trash can. Well, his wife, she took the manuscript out of the trash can. She sent it to the agent. He loved it. He gave the author $450,000 for the rights to the book. The book was called Carrie, And the author was Stephen King. And the only reason he got published was because of his wife having that belief in him. There's another story I talk about where it was a successful screenwriter and he had two daughters. And every night he used to tell bedtime stories to his little girls. And his wife overheard him and she's like, "You should turn that into a book." And he said, I'm not a writer. I'm a screenwriter." And she's like, "Well, why don't you write the book and then make it into a movie?" And so he took the stories, he put them into a book, he called the book The Princess Bride. His name was William Goldman. It became one of my favorite movies of all time. And I'm trying, you know, you stump me, Claudia, because I'm actually, for the life of me,
I'm sure you'll come up with one.
Self-published. Yeah, I got a
female.
Well, I mean, I always told people that when I'm talking to writers, I'm like, you know, I'm a big fan of poetry. It's the best ways to learn how to read and write, I said. Mm-hmm. And there's Emily Dickinson has a poem, XXVII, because I never learned Roman numerals. And it goes, "I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us, don't tell. They banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog." And when I tell that to students, I'm like, if you listen to this poem, this woman had some serious self-esteem issues.
Sure.
And I'm like, a lot of people don't know this. Emily Dickinson didn't share her books when she was alive. She died. Uh-huh. They found her poems in the attic. Yeah. I mean, she had no idea the poetry she had and how it was going to affect millions of people. And I say this to people all the time. All of you, whether you're a poet or a business person or a good parent, you have poetry. You have something to offer to the world. Don't leave this planet until you've given it to the planet.
I'm going to share this last little tiny story. I'm an avid reader, I'm an audiobook reader mostly because I like moving, and when I move, I can listen and I can read, you know? The last book I just picked up, it was out of the corner of my eye, and I came across it by chance. Love, Lucy.
Oh.
Read and by Lucille Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And read by Lucy Arnaz, her daughter.
Cool.
And
nice.
The book was written by Lucille Ball at the end of the 50s, it was 1959, and it was hidden. And when both of her parents passed, their parents passed, they found the manuscript. Someone sent her the manuscript because it was recorded and transcribed and now in a book. It was absolutely, in one day, not even a day and a half, maybe, tops. I went right through its history, details, show business. It was fabulous, fabulous. And, you know, what category does that go in? Down memory lane? Or what was it like in the McCarthy era, you know, when she was, you know, it was just fabulous. And there's not enough time in the day to do all that reading, really, you know? It's just not enough time. And
what's your favorite genre, Claudia?
Well, I'm getting into, for many, many years, of course, the thrillers, political thrillers. I love it because I was a conference interpreter and I worked for politics. I do work for politics all the time. But now I'm getting out of that and I'm getting into the paranormal romance. Paranormal romance, and because I'm leaning my writing towards that. And I'm going to put a psychic spin on it.
Well, you see, though, you just gave your audience a really good tip, though. If you're going to write that kind of book, you need to read other books in that genre, which you're absolutely right. That's the way
and
to
you
do
have
it.
Well, you have to know your competition when when any kind of business, right?
Well, I've always told people I have no such thing as competition. I only have potential collaborators.
I get that, sure. Thank you so much, Danny Brussel, for taken advantage of your time. We've been on for so long.
Well, Claudia, before I leave, I just wanted to make sure to serve your audience one more way. If they go to freegiftfromdanny.com, again, freegiftfromdanny.com, I'm going to give away everybody a complimentary e-copy of my book, Read, Lead, and Succeed. It's a book I wrote for a school principal who was trying to keep his faculty positively engaged. So I said, okay, I'll write you a book. So every week I give you a concept, an inspirational quote, an inspirational story, a book recommendation on a book you should read, but you're probably too lazy because you're an adult. So I also give you a children's picture book recommendation that demonstrates the same concept. Plus, I'll give you access to a five-day reading challenge I recently did with about 700 parents around the world, where for a week, for an hour a day, you'll get all kinds of tips from me on how to get your kid to read more, read better, and most importantly, love reading. So that's for
all
of your audience.
Tell us again where we can find that.
Freegiftfromdanny.com.
Freegiftfromdanny.com. Thank you so, so much. I'll be looking for that.
Thanks, Claudia. I love it. Thanks for all that you do.
I hope our paths cross again.
Absolutely.
Especially when the new book comes out. Maybe yeah. That'll be the time.
Bye-bye, Danny. I'm going to try and finish it over the holidays.
Oh, he says, did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah. Bye-bye, Danny.
Bye-bye.